Good afternoon. My name is Peter Christensen. I'll be your lunchtime companion today. Thank you all for spending the afternoon with us today and coming to hear a little discussion of home delivery, fabricating the modern dwelling, which, as you may have seen, if you have not already been, I hope you'll go immediately after, but is the very ambitious exhibition that we organized, opened in July, and runs for another 3 weeks. Just a sort of housekeeping note, on October 15th, we'll be holding a symposium called Homemade, in which all five of the architects of the contemporary houses you see outside will be speaking in a panel. So please put that on your calendar. It's at 6 p.m., I believe, on Wednesday, October 15th. I'm going to try to talk about the content of the exhibition in a sort of abbreviated format, because it's really quite a dense show. It spans sort of two locations. It spans 180 years, over 100 architectural projects. So unfortunately, I've had to edit quite a bit out of this presentation, but we'll give you some snapshots of the show along the way. Can we get the lights down a little bit? Is that possible? Thank you. This image, sort of one of the most stellar images that grace our publication, and is actually the cover of our exhibition catalog, and is sort of emblematic, I think, of the story of prefabrication. This is a photo from 1949 of the Lustron House, and all of the pieces of it laid out flat in a yard with the five workers ready to assemble this. This would have taken them just under 2 weeks to assemble. And as you can see, it really is a kit of parts, and it sort of symbolizes the house as a machine for living, but also as a factory-made product. And really the fascination with the factory-made house is something that we'll find begins in the early 19th century. So from here we'll trace some of the roots. But before we go into the sort of historical context, I think it's important to put it in a contemporary context and try to understand why we did this exhibition today, and what makes it relevant in 2008, besides, of course, the mortgage crisis. Here we see two publications, if you will. One, on the left, we have a sales catalog of the Sears, Roebuck & Company from 1908, and some of their initial prefabricated house designs that would become quite ubiquitous in the American landscape in the early 20th century. And then a more recent publication of Dwell Magazine being one of the sort of more recent champions of prefabrication, and perhaps one of the best indicators as to how prefabrication has become a sort of hot topic in recent years. And we were sort of perplexed as to why, because the prefabricated house has always been a sort of crucial issue in modernism, but why now, and why is it experiencing a renaissance? So this is a little slow. I have to go back. Okay. As I mentioned, the exhibition is located in two pieces of real estate. One is inside and one is outside. Pardon for the lightness of the plan on the right, but the plan on the left is our north gallery on the sixth floor, and the plan on the right is an empty 18,000 square foot piece of land that the museum had available to it for only a short time, because it is the site, or it is going to be the site of the new Jean Nouvel building, which will break ground next year. Really quite an illustrious site, and really quite an opportunity for us to do something pretty remarkable at a scale which the museum is not sort of customarily doing. So we, from a very early stage, made a sort of bifurcation of the content of the exhibition, not only in terms of a chronology, but also in terms of the representation. So the historical part of the show, or perhaps a better word is contextual part of the show, would sit in the gallery. And this would consist of primarily the sort of objects you would expect to see in an architecture exhibition. So models, plans, photographs, perhaps some fragments. While the outdoor seemed ripe for doing something at full scale, and times that by five. So we decided that the full scale would be sort of most appropriate for the contemporary practitioners, and what we would do is we would use the gallery as a way to contextualize five contemporary works that we would put outside. This is the site. While they were installing Sarah, so you get a sense of what it looks like from above. But more importantly, within the sort of context of the museum, there's a story as well, which is that Philip Johnson, who was the chief curator of the department, well, the founder and the chief curator of the department for quite some time, had actually thought of this before. This is not, we shouldn't take too much credit. He had really imagined that full-scale architecture was the best way for viewers to experience architecture and to understand it. So in 1949, he initiated an exhibition program called the Museum House in the Garden, which was a sort of short-lived but very important part of exhibition history, the museum's history, and also architectural history. And what the first such exhibition was this full-scale house designed by Marcel Breuer called the Museum House in the Garden, which was built in the summer of 1949. But a little known fact is that the summer before, in 1948, the Lustron Company, whose house parts we saw in that initial image, built a model home on the corner of 52nd Street and 6th Avenue, which Philip Johnson was walking by every day on his way to work. This was supposed to be a house that people on their way to Grand Central or to the Port Authority would check out on their way home as a house that they could potentially build in the New York suburbs for themselves. This being during the housing crisis in the post-war years. And Johnson saw this house as an affront to modernism. He decried its material usage of porcelain enameled steel as completely inhospitable to the human sort of needs, and also the sort of pitched roof formalism of the house was really quite regressive in his mind. So this we'll bring these two projects, the Breuer House and the Lustron House, into confrontation in the gallery, which I'll talk about later. But it was a sort of provocative reevaluation of not only architectural history, but the museum's history for us. So beginning in the chronology, we have some early works which come out of both Europe and the United States, which really lay the seeds for prefabrication and some of the sensibilities that would emerge into the turn of the century. This is a drawing of a joinery system of the balloon frame. Now, the balloon frame is something that is really something that you're probably quite familiar with, despite the fact that you may never have heard the term. It's simply a wooden stud frame wall that is held together by nails. Why is that interesting? Well, the nail was actually an innovation at this time, and the nail actually allowed construction to occur far more rapidly. And on top of that, as the United States was building its frontiers in the Midwest and the West Coast, there was no skilled labor. The sort of skilled woodworking was a product of European culture, and the joineries and sort of craftsmanship that Europeans were accustomed to was simply not possible in the U.S. because there was no skill to do it. So the balloon frame was really an American invention that allowed houses to be built quickly and affordably and with very little labor, skilled labor. And so when you picture a barn raising, that's what they're raising, is a sort of balloon frame wall. On the other side of the Atlantic, the balloon frame, and nails were being used in a sort of different vein, which was colonial usages. So countries like England were colonizing parts of the world that they had no idea what to expect they were finding at that time. So really the first sort of example of a prefabricated house that was marketed and fairly successful is this Manning Portable Cottage, which was designed by a London carpenter for his son who was emigrating to Australia, specifically what is now Adelaide. And as his son was leaving, he had no idea what they would find. And of course, anyone of means wanted to imagine themselves in somewhat of a comfortable situation upon arrival in the colony. So the pieces of this house were fabricated entirely in London and then packed so that they could ship easily on a boat and with two mules and a few days' labor, they could be hauled up to a specific site in Australia and built. So we see the sort of colonial ramifications of prefabrication as well here. As we move far forward in time to the year 1906, we have a sort of wealth of imaginative designs that occur at the turn of the century, along with the technological revolution that is occurring. And one of the most exciting examples is Thomas Edison's single-pore concrete house, which he began work on in 1906. Now, Edison was a sort of curious character for us because, of course, he is most commonly thought of as an inventor, not as an architect. And very little is known about this house as opposed to, say, some of his other inventions. So I did some digging and found out that Edison had begun a fascination with concrete in the early 20th century, and he had designed various kilns that he had patented. And why exactly was he fascinated with concrete when he was doing things that were far more sort of interesting? Well, it was because Edison had grown up on the Lower East Side, and he had actually grown up in a wood frame building that was infested with vermin and became incredibly dirty. And he really saw his role as an inventor to elevate the human condition, to improve hygienic conditions in sort of affordable housing. And he thought concrete was the answer. It was more easily cleaned. It was sturdier. And so what he imagined here was a balloon frame mold that would make this sort of cavity, and then a kiln and an elevator would bring concrete to the top of this structure and feed the concrete through a funnel at the top, and the concrete would settle down to the bottom and cure in successive layers. Now, ultimately, this was not successful because the kilns were not producing a mixture of powder to water that was homogeneous, so that when these different layers would meet, cracking would occur, and eventually the houses fell into disrepair. Although several dozen of these were built in New Jersey near Edison's studio, and a few still stand today. You can see Edison here with the original model that him and his workshop built. This model was something that I fell upon at the Edison National Archives and is a highlight of the exhibition and one of the first objects that you see when you walk in. And here is a picture of the house under construction in 1918 in Phillipsburg, New Jersey. Moving to film, actually, not to another architectural piece, this is actually a still from Buster Keaton's 1920 film, One Week. I don't know how many of you are familiar with it, but it is a masterpiece of American silent film, and really something that, despite the fact that I've seen it about 55 times, I still laugh every time I watch it. One Week. The storyline of the film is that a newlywed couple receives a prefabricated house from the bride's rich uncle. And the jilted lover of the bride, when they're not looking, renumbers the boxes. So as Buster Keaton and Sybil Seeley, the actress, move to their new plot of land somewhere in the American heartland, the house goes up, and slowly but surely you can tell that something is terribly wrong. And it is a wonderful comedy, which actually opens our exhibition. We have an 8-minute loop of it on the title wall of the exhibition. Taking a quick break to sort of think about prefabrication, here are several examples, which I won't read out loud, but of course the definition, particularly today, is really in flux, and I think that these are definitions that we were sort of wrestling with the whole time, and how exactly you define prefabrication. Certainly there's a broad range of definitions, and it's important to sort of have that in mind. I'll talk a little bit more about this later. And this is just an image I love. To that point of you know, how do you define prefabricated, and a little interlude there, sorry. But I showed you Edison's patent drawing of the single pour concrete house. I don't know if I mentioned that, but that actually was the drawing that Edison submitted to the U.S. Patent Office for the single pour concrete house, and the patent drawings play a major role in our exhibition. There's an entire wall of patent drawings, which are, of course, as conceived of as replicable objects and intellectual property. It plays a major role in prefabrication that is often neglected in the history, because many architects who see themselves as designers of replicable objects, of course, feel that also the need to patent it and lay claim to the sort of intellectual rights to it. And that is not exempt some of our most important architects, including Buckminster Fuller, Conrad Waxman, Frank Lloyd Wright, and here Le Corbusier, who his seminal drawing for the Maison Domino as a sort of pre-architectural diagram of what a building should look like was actually a patent drawing that he submitted to the French Patent Office, which is a little known fact. A lot of sort of architecture students and architectural historians know the drawing, but they don't know that it was actually a patent drawing. So moving ahead in time quickly, we have to sort of speed through this. But this is an object from MoMA's collection, and part of our objectives in pulling all the objects together for the interior part of the show was to actually try to draw as much as we could upon the museum's collection. And this is a model of Buckminster Fuller's 1941 Wichita House, which is actually a redo of his 1927 Dymaxion House, which is a house basically suspended on a single mast, which you see there in the center, and made of lightweight aluminum. So at the time, it was completely radical. There was no such house that was either made of aluminum or completely round or contained the mechanized systems that Fuller thought was so important to this concept, you know, including a machine for corporal cleaning, which was essentially just a shower, basically a lazy Susan, which would deliver your sweater to you every morning, and several other features of the like. Now, the Whitney did a Buckminster Fuller monographic show, which perhaps you saw, and we tried not to compete with them. So Fuller is perhaps a little underemphasized in our exhibition, but that's because the Whitney did a fine job of rounding that out for us. And this is an image. Back to the Lustron. The Lustron Corporation, in the history of this story, is actually sort of one of the most successful and also one of the most tragic. It was not until after the war, when there was such a severe housing for GIs, that the U.S. government actually finally sponsored some prefabricated housing. It had been an issue that Fuller had tried to get the government to sponsor it, and they just were not biting. But finally, when really the need seemed quite desperate, the U.S. government got behind it, and the company that they pumped the most money into was the Lustron Corporation. The Lustron Corporation was conceived by a gentleman named Carl Strandlund, who was a Swedish inventor who had the idea of reappropriating munitions factories, or a munition factory in Ohio, as a prefabricated house factory. So suddenly all these factories were defunct after the war and had no purpose. So Strandlund spent quite a bit of time with a series of engineers finding ways to recalibrate the machines that were making guns and ammunition to make houses. So it is really a sort of fascinating piece of technology transfer from war production to house production. And here you see that even the the delivery of the house on this specially made truck was customized. This house was specific. This car was specifically for the Lustron house, and all of the pieces were basically fed onto this plate, which was the plate that the house sat on the truck. So it was entirely systematized. And there again, you see once it's taken off the truck what it looks like. And that's a publicity image. Time magazine in 1949, who considered themselves the sort of watchdog or arbiters of architectural taste of the sort of post-war boom, it's amazing how much commentary they had on housing at that time. And I think Time magazine, for whatever reason, really concerned themselves with it. But Time magazine was a heavy opponent of the Lustron, and they likened the house to living in a hot dog stand, which was how many people felt who lived in them as well, because they had no choice, because they were largely deployed on naval bases and Air Force bases. And but some people took pride in their houses, and the fact that the house was entirely magnetic, all the material was porcelain enameled steel, which was the same material that previously had only been seen in gas stations and White Castle restaurants. People took pride in that, and they actually showed off the fact that the house was magnetic by hanging all their pictures with magnets. There you see an interior shot. Contemporaneously, Marcel Breuer, who one would suspect, based on The House and the Garden, was really only interested in one-off, singular, expensive works, was actually very interested in prefabrication. And here you see his 1949 Place Two Point house, which really, according to Breuer, takes inspiration from the aircraft industry. So you can see here that the sort of structure is one of a sort of central spine which cantilevers on either side, and that the house only rests on two points, which would allow it to negotiate any or far more topographies than, say, a house that rested on four points or that rested directly on the ground. He also became very involved with the company Monsanto, the plastic manufacturer, to develop this house as a wood frame house that would subsequently be coated in a sort of liquid plastic to make it far more durable. And this sort of preempts a series of new material explorations. So we'll move out of simply steel and wood and into a vast array of materials into the 50s and 60s. My slide is freezing. There we go. But before we get there, we'll quickly talk about the Maison Tropicale by Jean Prouvé, because, of course, Jean Prouvé is really the main protagonist of prefabrication in Europe. In 1948, also contemporaneous with the Lustron, the House in the Garden, and the Place Two Point house, he designs the Maison Tropicale, which is, you may have seen in Queens 2 years ago. It was auctioned off by Christie's and reconstituted under the 59th Street Bridge. But the house was an entirely different system than, say, the Lustron. It was rather a sort of simple set of parts that minimized the number of units, and actually was designed here for the Air France headquarters in Brazzaville in the French Congo. So this was really made for airplane transfer as opposed to, say, road or ship. We see a wonderful picture. My slides are very slow. Here are some of the parts. And here's the plane in the Congo with the parts being unloaded.
And special.
Yes, it was. So here you see the house as it was constructed. And it's hard to sort of point out these. We have a wonderful film in the show, which I hope you'll see, which shows how all these pieces come together. But this sort of porthole door that was operable, you could sort of turn it so that you could open it up to air circulation, which was very important in this climate. A really sort of wonderful palette of materials. And the central structure was, as opposed to, say, the Lustron, which was just basically a series of walls which supported the interior, the Prouvé house actually had a central portico, or portique in French, which held it all from the very central point, and everything then rested on either these cross beams or these pediments, which held it rigid, which you'll see in the gallery. We have part of a Prouvé fragment, which is a house, a series of fragments from a house, which was a reconjugation of this same system. And here's a picture of it in Queens. So here we take a little bit of a jump into that material exploration that I was telling you about into the 1960s. This UFO lands from Finland, from an architect, Matti Suuronen, who, again, sort of issue of reappropriation, did a fascinating thing with his genre, which was grain silos. He was a civil engineer, and he reappropriated the same equipment that was manufacturing grain silos in Finland to actually manufacture houses. So what you see here is actually the exact same dimensions of what would be the top of a grain silo, but this time made out of plastic and sitting on this sort of these legs with this drop down door that is clearly an analogy to an airplane or a UFO perhaps. And this is perhaps even wilder. This is Archogram's living pod of 1968, which was never built, but was an interesting departure for them. Archogram being sort of a seminal firm in the group called the Metabolists. The Metabolists, who were preoccupied with the notion of the megastructure, the sort of vast scaffolding, if you will, in which units plugged or clipped onto as they please. So it was a sort of ephemeral, constantly in flux structure. And this, for them, is a radical departure because it's actually the first structure they designed that is devoid of the megastructure and actually autonomous. So they imagine this as a completely self-sustained unit that was that could be lived in and could actually walk itself to various places. So those legs that you see there actually could allow it to rove, apparently the moon, but could be Earth as well. And then we come back down to Earth a little bit in the late 60s with the beginning of the high-tech school of architects who emerged from England. This is one of the early seminal projects of that school, designed by Richard Rogers, who is still in full practice today. And this was one of his earliest, sort of most famous but never built projects, called the Zip-Up House. And the Zip-Up House is essentially a series of these ribbons, which could be purchased off the shelf and then attached to one another as needed by the client. This was submitted for a competition sponsored by DuPont. So DuPont was very interested in having the architects experiment with various materials and think of new ways to use the materials that they were engineering. And what you see here is actually, the sort of various conjugations that they could come up with. You know, perhaps you have a space between them and you create a sort of patio. You could fold down one side of it like a leaf and create a terrace. But also, magically, there's a turbine, but there's also a place to plug in your car. So he was imagining an electric car in 1969. I mean, this is this is proto-sustainable in my book, and it's really quite amazing to think that this was being done 40 years ago. Unfortunately, never built. And then the move into 1972 with the actual demise of the Metabolist movement, really the last great project in that vein, which was designed by Kisho Kurokawa here in his Nakagin capsule tower in Tokyo in 1972, and really is one of the sort of only projects within the exhibition that is a sort of anti-nuclear family project. And really this was designed for bachelors who were working late hours into the night in Tokyo and apparently didn't have enough time to get on the train and go home to their families, so they would stay here. It really became a little bit of a den of iniquity, but it's a wonderful architectural project, and I think has just been, a demolition has just started on this, which is very sad. waiting for my slide. There we go. Somewhat in a sort of formal similarity is a project that comes to us from Israel. This is by the architect Zvi Hecker in 1975 for a housing project called the Ramat Housing Complex. Hecker was a sort of student of the metabolist movement and sort of like his contemporary Moish Safdie began to sort of translate it into something different, although you can still see the language. But it was an interesting case in what he was doing in Israel because with the huge influx of immigrants into Israel, there was a huge need for housing, and for many years they were living in these sort of improvisational settlements called the Ma'abarat, which were basically just tents and tin dwellings. And this was specifically made for a very Orthodox community. So the Ma'abarat was not serving the various religious requirements that architecture had to follow. And he created this complex which, in various ways, adhered to that sort of orthodoxy. So what you see here is actually a series of house units, which are these sort of clusters with these pentagonal faces. And these pentagonal concrete faces were prefabricated and clipped into this sort of concrete central structure, which you see in the center and sort of up here on the top. Eventually, the Israeli government pulled Hecker off the project and used another technique and finished the complex using a different system. So actually, these wound up not being prefabricated, but two of the five wings of this project were looked like this. And then into the 80s, we have the sort of another late British high-tech architect named Richard Horton, who is actually one of the architects on the lot, who really sort of finds another way to do what Rogers was doing in that, you know, creating a series of off-the-shelf parts that he did with his zip-up house and not really prescribing any particular way that the house could look that was completely customizable by the client. Here you see Horton doing a similar thing with this sort of kit of parts, these steel beams, these trusses, these little legs, and these cladding systems. And he basically just designed this palette of materials in which any given customer could customize it for themselves, which begins to speak to some of the sort of emerging fascination that we have noticed, which is called mass customization, sort of moving away from the notions of mass standardization to mass customization, in which the sort of factory-madeness of a house could still coexist with a sort of personal or individual quality, which is, of course, what most people want because they don't necessarily want something that looks cookie-cutter, but they do want the price advantages of something that's factory-made. So back to that discussion of the definition, this is one of the more provocative projects that we came across, which was designed just about 6 years ago by the Guatemalan architect Teddy Cruz here in Tijuana. Neither this nor this is Cruz's. What he designed is actually this sort of scaffolding system, this red truss. And sort of like Horton, this truss and this sort of series of scaffolding parts is actually completely off the shelf. And this is what the dwellers of these favelas in Tijuana can buy to sort of improvise in their setting. So what you see here is actually a pretty fascinating use of the materials to actually lift one house above the other. And whether you like it or not, it's pretty provocative. So now here we are at MoMA in the exhibition, and this is our title wall. There I mentioned the Buster Keaton film. And then we commissioned, and I was speaking about that graduation from mass standardization to mass customization. We actually commissioned three contemporary practitioners to think about ways in which, say, a standard wall unit could be made in the factory, but also be completely customized to a specific set of needs or a specific client. And so here is one such example by the New York firm Reiser Umamoto. Sorry, that shouldn't be there. So here we are inside, and here you can see the Edison film that I was talking about, a series of the Prouvé fragments from the Maison Tropicale and other reconjugations of Prouvé's constructive system. And then it was hard to do this because I didn't want to go on forever, but film plays a major role in our exhibition. And you can see that here on the upper strata of the gallery, so we have all the objects on this level and then the film on the upper level. We actually organized a series of six films divided chronologically, which were culled from industrial footage, many films that had never been seen before, which spoke to the premise that this is a show about process, not about product. We really wanted to emphasize how things are made, not the end result. And that was the risk that we ran with simply putting objects out. So the film is really elemental to the success of this contextual part of the show in showing that. And there is a wonderful amount of varied footage from all across the globe in there. And you really can see how long this has been going on, and even more wonderfully, how long it's been documented. There was really quite some wonderful finds in this film research. Moving forward, what you see here is that Prouvé fragment of the house that I was talking about. This was actually just a sort of not particularly distinguished version that he made in the same vein as the Maison Tropicale, but here for the house for a primary school headmistress in a town near Nancy in France. And then behind it, you see a blow-up of Breuer's house in the garden directly next to the Lustron. And I've already explained why that's a provocative gesture. And then we fold back as we sort of move counterclockwise through the gallery into the more recent material. So what you actually see here is a sort of huge table of models in that post-Lustron period from 1950 to 1990, let's say, where all the projects are represented by models, but also by some materials on the wall. And you really see the huge variety and the range of materials that occur for that 40-year period. And then back to the very end. So some of the most recent projects. This was Teddy Cruz here, looking back on the rest of the exhibition. So the idealized route that you walk through this show, which is, of course, what every curator wants you to do, but no one will ever do it in reality, is follow this line, this chronological line, and then loop back. But, of course, there's always going to be an interchange, and there's these wonderful juxtapositions that occur as a result of having this fold onto itself with the most recent material and the oldest material. And then, of course, we move outside, and we have five houses out there, and I think that one thing that even the most untrained eye will notice is that they are incredibly different and incredibly diverse in terms of their material, in terms of their size, in terms of their approach, in many different ways. And I think that's what we were trying to emphasize, was not who are the most successful people, but what are the possibilities and what are the formal, material, and procedural possibilities of prefabrication, rather than sort of prescribe something or celebrate only the people who have been successful. Really, only one of the five architects' projects are commercially viable. They're only one of them that's actually on the market. But the point was to open up the discussion. And so that is the Burst House. Here, that previous image was the Burst House by the New York duo Douglas Gauthier and Jeremy Edmiston in its original incarnation in Australia, where the client was an Anglican surfer priest, which is an interesting client for them. And here it is in New York. And it's hard to see, but really, for me, the most exciting part of this project is sort of twofold. One is that it's laser cut basically modeled entirely on the computer, and then the file is sent to a laser cutter, which essentially cuts out these pieces of plywood from a sort of standardized sheet. But more importantly, these pieces, once cut, are joined, the main structure is joined together by these flexible clips that are basically X-shaped and allow them to sort of fold in and out like an accordion. So imagine this entire, the length of this structure, and you can see the sort of the roof and the underbelly of the house is an accordion sort of lattice-like shape, which actually arrived on its side entirely flat. It was then lifted and then expanded like an accordion and then placed on this steel frame to secure it into place. So structurally, this is something that we had never seen before and was entirely sort of bizarre and fantastic at the same time. And here you see three of the houses, the Cellophane House by Kieran Timberlake on the left, the Micro Compact House by Richard Horton in the middle, and the digitally fabricated housing for New Orleans on the right. Talk quickly about the Cellophane House. Kieran Timberlake is probably the most established of the firms, and you may be familiar with them, but the house is really a sort of material exploration. Formally, it's fairly regular. It's just a sort of volume, a sort of typical four-story volume, the dimensions of which were built out to meet the sort of standard Philadelphia row house, because the architects are based in Philadelphia. But what you see here is the house divided into a series of 13 chunks, which you see here being locked into one another by a crane. And locked into is an important distinction, because it is not a steel frame house, despite its height. It's actually an aluminum house, so that when these pieces meet, they are joined together by bolts and by sliding one onto the other on these tracks. They are not welded together, so they are not fixed. And as a result, the house is entirely scalable. It could go up, it could go down, and when its use is done, as it will be here in just a matter of weeks, it can be moved and reconstituted elsewhere. But in addition to that, there's a sort of wonderful material exploration, which you see here in their the east and west faces of the house with this material called smart wrap, which is a series of photovoltaic cells embedded between two pieces of very heavy-duty plastic and connected by these copper filaments, which basically harness energy from the sun, route the energy to a battery, which would be stored down here, and allow the house to potentially sustain itself completely off-grid. Unfortunately, because we have Saarinen's building behind us and skyscrapers on all four sides, we are not able to get enough light, but that is how it's supposed to work. And then the SAS house, which you see here on the left, is also a laser-cut house, but is really very different than the Burst house. And it is called the digitally fabricated housing for New Orleans because this particular iteration is conceived of for New Orleans, but it is very important not to get hung up on that. Actually, what the architect insists is that it is actually a house which is a sort of simple structure. So you see this box with the pitched roof. And then the decoration that is placed on this frontispiece or on this front porch is really something that could be customized to any particular vernacular location. So you could dress up this house in Bangalore, you could dress it up in Rio, you could dress it up in New Jersey, and it could have a different look. So this sort of applied decoration is something that's completely contextual to any given site. So this just happens to be for New Orleans as an example here of, you know, the sort of the gingerbread of the traditional vernacular shotgun house in New Orleans. But also it's a wonderful marriage of the sort of low-tech and the high-tech. And Sass, who is the only, he's an architect, but he's not a practicing architect. He's actually a professor at MIT. Imagines that this design could be made in Cambridge and sent by email to any computer in the world. And they now make portable laser cutter beds, so you can actually have this in the middle of nowhere as long as you have a power source, and you could feed these sheets of plywood through the machine, and you can make your house in a matter of days. Here's Sass with five of his students, and five students with five rubber mallets could make this house in 5 days. There is no secondary material, so there is no glue, there is no nails. And that is because these notches, which you see here in the pieces, and you see here, are actually places for these sort of connector pieces. They're either dumbbell-shaped or cross-shaped pieces which are hammered into place and hold the entire house in tension, like a classical archway with its keystone. And then this is perhaps the sort of most austere of the five. It's Oscar Leo Kaufman's System 3 house. Oscar Leo Kaufman is an Austrian architect who is sort of known for his high level of craftsmanship and has been in the prefab practice for quite some time. But for us, this was interesting because it really collapses a debate which is so prominent in the U.S., of the sort of flat pack versus the modular. So flat pack being how your IKEA furniture arrives and then you have to assemble it. Modular being something that's made entirely in the factory but is shipped with air in it because it's already assembled and hence is sort of less efficient in that regard. And there's this sort of back and forth between these two camps all the time. But what Kaufman does is sort of collapses that debate. So what he does is create a two-part house, which I hope you can see here from the roof, this bar being one and this bar being the other. And this bar is the wet bar, so the wet part of the house, so the bathroom, the kitchen, but also the vertical circulation. And then this is the sort of living space. So this part of the house, this module, is made entirely in the factory, and it is slipped into the center of a shipping container. This part is actually just a series of five planar pieces, so the roof, the three facades, and the floor. And those flat pieces are placed in the shipping container next to the module flat. So this entire house fits in one shipping container and is extracted on-site, and then these pieces lock into the modular piece. And I believe that when this house arrived on June 22nd, I think there's a wonderful video of it on the website, they began work at 9 a.m. and the architects were having drinks at the Austrian Cultural Forum by 12. So it really was the fastest of the five. And then finally there's the micro compact house, which you see both here and here, which was provocative to us as a sort of manifesto of minimal living. Some would say too minimal, but it's 76 square feet. And the architect says that up to four people can live in it. I don't quite buy it, but it is a manifesto, and that the architect insists that in this day and age, we not only reduce only our carbon footprint, but also our literal footprint, and imagine ways to sort of downsize our lives, which seems very timely right now, and sort of digitize all our books, digitize our files, part with all but three of our outfits, part with all but one pan and one pot, and this is what the architect demands for the inhabitant of this house to do. So it is actually oddly the project that some people, despite its sort of rather pleasant appearance, react the most radically against, because they just do not see it as a way of life that they could possibly imagine. But it is meant to be provocative, and it is meant to inspire people to think about these issues, which are very important in this day and age. You see here that the house has a sort of mast, like a ship, and this could be the mast that actually contains a photovoltaic cell, which it does now. It was actually added later, but also a turbine. So like the Cairn Timberlake house, this house could be completely off-grid. So I think there you see a publicity shot of it in Germany, where it is actually in production with a smart car. And that's it. I'll take a few questions. I think we're almost out of time, but... Has everyone seen the show? Has anyone not gone yet? You should go after this. Yes?
Could you speak briefly about the projects that were included and why?
Well, we did a dragnet of several hundred firms, contemporary firms, and asked about 800 firms to submit portfolios that we evaluated, and the goal was really to address the diversity of the materials and the procedures, and to us these five were really the sort of best combination, not only on their own but as an ensemble. The historical works were a little more research-based, and that we didn't actually have things coming through the door. We were actively looking for materials and books and archival materials and the like. But that was really the objective, is addressing these sort of this range. And I think that without getting too pointed, there's been several publications and several exhibitions as of late that really are not pushing the envelope in terms of the architectural discourse. I mean, you see a lot of very lovely boxes, but they're really sort of sentimental in many ways, and they recall a sort of mid-century modernism. And to us, while that was all fine and good and quite pleasant, it wasn't really pushing the discourse forward. And our goal was really to try to do that to the best of our ability without being too prescriptive. So, yes?
Do you know the exhibit and the cost of the
We do. And that's a very good question, because it was actually something that we had to grapple with, because so you never come to MoMA to see a price tag on a work of art. And it was really an unusual thing for us to do, but we thought, because of the nature of the subject of this exhibition, that it was relevant. We didn't want to make that the be-all, end-all of it, because to us, that was not the most important thing, but it was certainly important. And you will find on the five placards on the houses outside the price tags. Now, it was funny, because we allowed the architects to decide how that price was listed. So by square foot, anticipated cost in full production, there's various language in which it's written, but all of them have some sort of annotation as to the cost. And within the historical works, it is sometimes mentioned in the catalog when the information is relevant. So that's it. All right. Thank you. Enjoy your day.